Over the ensuing millennia, numerous Carino emperors, concubines, and bastard children were also buried here. Some had been cremated and their ashes displayed in urns, while the bones of others were ground up to make porcelain funereal pieces. A few rulers were encased in transparent sarcophagi, sealed within null entropy fields so that their bodies would never decay, even if their meager accomplishments were obscured by the fog of passing time. As Fenring and Shaddam continued, they passed the sallow-faced old mummy of Mandius the Terrible, who lay in a chamber fronted by a fearsome, life-size statue of himself. According to the placard on his coffin, he was known as the Emperor Who Made Worlds Tremble. "I am not impressed." Shaddam looked at the withered husk. "Nobody even remembers him." "Only because you refused to study imperial history," Fenring countered with a thin smile. "Does a place such as this call to mind your own mortality, The Emperor scowled, surrounded by the rippling light of the mobile glow-globes. As they proceeded along the sloped rock floor, tiny creatures at the periphery skittered into shadows and cracks. Spiders, rodents, modified scarabs that managed to survive by eating scraps of long-preserved flesh. "What is this I hear about Elrud having a bastard son, How could this have been hidden from us all these years?" Shaddam whirled. "How do you know about that?" Fenring answered with a condescending smile. "I have ears, Shaddam. They are too large. But used only in your service, sire, He continued to speak, not waiting for the Emperor to make further excuses. "It does not appear that this Tyros Repha has any desire for your throne, but in these times of growing unrest he might be used as a figurehead by rebellious families, a rallying point."
"But I am the true Emperor!"
"Sire, while the Landsrad swears fealty to House Carino, they show no loyalty to you personally. You have managed to irritate many of the most powerful nobles. Hasimir, I am not required to worry about my subjects' bruised egos." Shaddam looked at the tomb of the ancient Mandius and muttered a curse against his old father Elrud for getting a child on one of his concubines. Surely an emperor should have taken precautions. As the need for burials continued century after century, the necropolis had been dug deeper, with more crypts hollowed out. In the lowest and most recent subterranean levels, Shaddam actually recognized some of the names of his ancestors. Ahead lay the walled-up vault of Shaddam's grandfather, Fondiel III, known as the Hunter. The pitted iron door was flanked by the stuffed carcasses of two ferocious predators the man had killed, a spiny ecadrogue from the high plateaus of Ekaz, and a tufted saber bear from Three Delta Kaizing. Fondiel, however, had taken his epithet from hunting men, ferreting out enemies and destroying them. His big game adventures had been a mere diversion. Shaddam and Fenring passed coffins and chambers for children and siblings, and finally an idealized statue of Elrud IX's first heir, Fafnir. Years ago, Fafnir's death, an accident arranged by young Fenring, had opened Shaddam's path to the throne. Complacent, Fafnir had never imagined that his little brother's friend could possibly be dangerous. Only suspicious Elrud had imagined that Fenring and Shaddam might have been behind the murder. Though the boys never confessed, Elrud had cackled knowingly. "It shows initiative that you are able to make difficult decisions. But do not be so eager to take the responsibility of an emperor. I still have many years left in my reign, and you must observe my example. Watch and learn." And now Shaddam had to worry about the bastard Repha, too. He finally led Fenring to where the sealed ashes of Elrud IX waited in a relatively small alcove, adorned with shimmering diamond plaz, ornate scrollwork, and fine gems. A sufficient display of Shaddam's grief at the loss of his beloved father. The glow globes came to a halt and shone down like bright embers. Disrespectfully, Shaddam leaned against the resting place of his father's ashes. The old man had been cremated to foil any Sukh physician's attempts to determine the true cause of death. 20 years, Hasimir. We've waited that long for the Tleilaxu to create synthetic spice. Shaddam's eyes were bright, his gaze intent. What have you learned? Tell me when the master researcher is ready to go into full-scale production. I grow tired of waiting. Fenring tapped his own lips. I was most anxious to reassure us about the progress, sire, but I am not convinced that the substance has been thoroughly tested. It must meet our specifications. The repercussions of a mal will make the galaxy tremble. We dare not commit any tactical errors. What errors can there possibly be? He's had 2 decades to test it. The master researcher says it's ready. Fenring regarded the Emperor in the dim light. And you trust what a Tleilaxu says? Around him he could smell death and preservatives, perfumes, dust, and Shaddam's nervous sweat. I suggest we exercise caution. I am arranging for a final test, one that will give us all the proof we need. Yes, yes, give me no more details about your dull tests. I have seen Ajitika's reports, and I do not understand half of what he says. Just another month, Shaddam, perhaps 2. Impatient and brooding, the lean-faced emperor paced the crypt. Fenring tried to fathom the depth of his friend's mood. The glow globes, keyed to follow Shaddam, tried in vain to keep pace as he moved back and forth in the confined area. Hasimir, I am sick unto death of caution. All my life I have been waiting. Waiting for my brother to die, waiting for my father to die, waiting for a son. And now that I have the throne, I find myself waiting for Amal, so that I can finally have the power a Carino emperor deserves. He stared at his clenched fist, as if he could see the visible lines of power trickling through his fingers. I have a Choam directorship, yet it carries no real ability to command. The Combine does whatever it wishes, because they can outvote me at any turn. The Spacing Guild is not required by law to follow my decrees, and if I don't tread carefully, they could impose sanctions, withdraw transportation privileges, and shut down the entire Imperium. I understand, sire. But far more damaging, I believe, are the increasing examples of nobles defying and ignoring your commands. Look at Grumman and Ekaz. They continue their petty little war in violation of your peacekeeping efforts. Viscount Mauritani practically spat in your face. Shed glossy black beetle, which succeeded in scuttling to safety in a crack. Perhaps it is time to remind everyone exactly who is in command. When I have a mal at my disposal, they will all have to dance to my tune. Spice from Arrakis will be prohibitively expensive. Fenring was contemplative, though. Many great houses have gathered their own melange stockpiles, though it is against an admittedly ancient and obscure law. For centuries no one has bothered to enforce this edict. Shaddam glowered. What does that matter? Fenring's nose twitched. It matters, sire, because when the time comes to announce your monopoly on synthetic melange, such illegal stockpiles will allow the noble families to resist buying Amal for some time. I see. Shaddam blinked as if he had not considered this. He brightened. Then we must confiscate those hoards so that the other houses have no cushion when I cut off the flow of melange. True, sire, but if you alone crack down on hoarders, the great houses may rally against you. I suggest instead that you cement your alliances
so you can deliver imperial justice from a position of greater strength. Remember, honey can be a sticky trap as well as a sweet reward, Shaddam's impatience was clear.
What are you talking about?
Let the guild and Choam locate the perpetrators and bring evidence of guilt to you. Your own Sardaukar can confiscate the stockpiles, after which you reward Choam and the guild with a portion of the confiscated spice. The promise of such a prize should give them an incentive to uncover the most cleverly hidden hoards. Fenring watched the wheels turning in the Emperor's mind. In that way, sire, you maintain the moral high ground, while keeping the full cooperation of the guild and Choam. And you get rid of the Landsrad stockpiles. Shaddam smiled.
I shall begin at once. I'll make a decree.
Fenring cut him off. The wandering Glow-Globes paused, as the Emperor did. We will have to find some other way to deal with the spice on Arrakis itself. Perhaps we could install an overwhelming Imperial military force there to block access to the natural melange fields. The Guild would never transport the troops there, Hasimir. They won't cut their own throats. How else are we going to shut down operations on Arrakis? The tomb's idealized image of Elrud the Ninth seemed to be watching these discussions with amusement.
We might need a ruse, sire. I'm sure we could come up with a justification to take control away from House Harkonnen.
We could call it a change of fief. They're due for one in a decade or so anyway.
Can you imagine the Guild's reaction when they find out, Hasimir? After they've helped me ferret out the illegal spice stockpiles,
Shaddam said, twitching with excitement.
I have always been irked at the power of the Guild, but Melange is their Achilles.
Then a slow smile crept across his face, as an intriguing idea occurred to him. His look of delight made Fenring uneasy.
All right, Hasimir. We can score 2 victories with 1 blow.
The Count was puzzled.
Which 2 victories, sire? Tyros Refa. We know the bastard has been coddled by House Talagari. I believe he has an estate on Zanovar, which I can easily verify.
The Emperor's smile widened.
And if we were to find a convenient spice hoard on Zanovar, wouldn't that be a fine place to begin our crusade?
Fenring said with a grin of his own.
An excellent idea, sire. Zanovar would indeed make a perfect place for a vigorous first strike, a lovely example.
And if the bastard should accidentally be killed, all the better. The two men left the deepest crypts and began to walk uphill toward the main section of the palace. Fenring looked behind him to the end of the stone tunnel. The Carino necropolis might soon have need of another crypt. A true gift is not just the object itself. It is a demonstration of understanding and caring, a reflection of both the individual who gives and the one who receives. Docent Glax Othen. Excerpted lectures for House Talagari. On the verdant fern path of his Zanovar estate, Tyros Refa studied the scrollwork language on the laminated ticket in his hand, trying to interpret the obscure pictographs. He relished the challenge. Sunshine through the leafy canopy dappled the card. Puzzled, he looked up at his revered teacher and friend, Docent Glax Othen.
If you cannot read the words, Tyros, you will never appreciate the gift itself.
Though few members of the Talagari family remained alive, the docent was one of a long line of teacher lords who had inherited the fief from the last traditional nobleman and continued to operate it under the original name. He and Refa shared a naming day, separated by a gulf of decades, but bridged by an enduring friendship. Hummingbirds and jeweled butterflies flitted around the waving fern fronds, chasing each other in fast, colorful aerial maneuvers.
High in one of the scaly trees, an off-key songbird sounded like a dry, squeaky hinge. May the fate save me from an impatient teacher. Rafa was in his mid-40s, stout of build and athletic in his movements. His eyes held an unwavering intelligence. I can translate something about the Talagarian court here. Performance. Famous and mysterious. He drew in a quick breath. This is a ticket to the Suspenser Opera. Yes, I see the code now. The docent had given him only one ticket, knowing that Rafa would go alone, fascinated and voracious to learn, drinking in the experience. The old man himself no longer attended such off-world performances. With only a few years remaining in his life, he had laid out his time carefully and preferred to meditate and teach. Rafa studied the ticket's scrollwork and deciphered every word. This is a pass to go to the lighted tanks of Talagari Center, in fabled Artesia. I am invited to watch an illuminated dance presentation in subliminal languages, which describes the emotional overtones of the long and complex struggles of the interregnum. He traced a finger over the strange runes, content in his abilities. His gaunt mentor nodded with deep satisfaction. It is said that only 1 in 500 viewers can understand the nuances of the magnificent piece, and then only with extensive attention and training. Still, you will want to see the performance for its own sake. Rafa embraced the docent. A wonderful gift, sir. They veered off the wide cobblestone path onto a smaller gravel lane that crunched beneath their slippered feet. Rafa loved every corner of his modest estate. Several decades ago, Emperor Elrud had instructed the docent to raise a bastard child in comfort and secrecy, without instilling in him any hope of his heritage, but keeping him worthy of his Carino blood. The docent had taught him to savor quality rather than extravagance. Glax Othen gazed at the younger man's chisel-featured face. There is also a matter of some concern, Tyros. Another reason it is perhaps a wise idea for you to go to Talagari for a while. Leave your estate here. Just for a month or two. Rafa looked at the docent, instantly alert. Is this another puzzle? Unfortunately, not one for mere amusement. In the past 2 weeks, several men have made rather rigorous inquiries into you and your property. You have noticed this, correct? Rafa hesitated, only slowly growing concerned. It was perfectly innocuous, sir. One man was inquiring into prime real estate here on Zanavar, even hinting that he wanted to purchase my property. Another was a master gardener who wanted to study my conservatory. The third... They were all imperial spies, Othen said, cutting him off. Rafa was instantly speechless, and the teacher continued. I was suspicious and decided to check them out. The identifications they gave you were false, and all three came from Kaitain. It has taken me a bit of effort, but I have proven that those men are secretly in Emperor Shaddam's employ. Rafa pursed his lips, fighting his desire to blurt out questions. The docent would want him to sift through the consequences. So they were all lying. The Emperor is trying to check up on my home and me. Why, after all this time? Obviously, because he has just learned of your existence. The docent took on a stern demeanor, and his voice became pedantic as he remembered the great speeches he had given inside echoing halls filled with students. You could have had so much more, Tyros Rafa, and you deserve it precisely because you do not want it. It is something of an imperial paradox. I think you could be in some danger. The docent understood why the young man must maintain his quiet life and not call attention to himself. This bastard son of Elrud the Ninth had never posed any threat to Kaitain, had never shown any ambition or interest in imperial politics or the schemings of the Golden Lion Throne. Instead, Repha preferred to make his mark by entertaining audiences, performing under a stage name with off-world acting companies. He had studied with the Mimbanco teachers of House Jongleur, the greatest entertainers in the Imperium, actors so talented they could manipulate the strongest emotions in an audience's heart. Young Repha had loved those early years on Jongleur, and the docent had been exceedingly proud of him. Repha stiffened. This went beyond the bounds of what they were permitted to mention, even in private conversations.
"Do not speak openly of such things."
"Yes, I will leave this place and go to Talagari." Softening his tone, he added, "But you will diminish my pleasure in this wonderful gift. Come, see what I have gotten for you on this naming day." His face remained troubled, though. Repha clasped the ticket in his fingers, then turned to the old man and managed a smile. "You taught me, sir, that the act of giving is more effective by tenfold when it is reciprocated." The docent feigned surprise. "Right now we have greater concerns. I have no need of gifts." Repha took his mentor by the bony elbow and steered him through a hedge of feather trees that opened into a central courtyard. "Neither do I. But neither of us ever makes time to treat ourselves to little pleasures unless we are forced into doing so. Don't deny the truth of what I say. I have arranged something for you, too. Look, there is Charence." The door-faced housemaster stood at the opposite side of the paved area, waiting for them by a scarlet pavilion. Charence looked to be a morose, ill-natured man, but he was highly efficient and had a bone-dry sense of humor that Repha appreciated. Abashed, Glax Othen followed the stocky young man to the pavilion, where he had placed a small wrapped box on a shaded table. Charence lifted the box and extended it to the docent. Othen took it in his hands. "What could I possibly want? Other than more time, and more knowledge, that is. And your safety." The old teacher tore open the foil wrapping with an expression of puzzled delight, followed by genuine confusion as he studied the shiny object. It was a crystal paschit, a one-day membership token. "An amusement park with rides and displays and thrill simulators?" Seeing his reaction, Dur Charence actually smiled. "Xanovar's finest," Repha said. "The children love it." He beamed. He had gone there himself, just to make certain it was not the sort of spot the overly serious docent would ever have visited. "But I have no children," he protested. "No family. This is not really for me, is it?" "Have some fun. Be young at heart. You have always insisted that a true human being requires new experiences for sustenance." The docent flushed. "I say that to my students, but..." "Are you trying to prove me hypocritical?" His brown eyes twinkled. Repha closed his mentor's hand over the token. "Enjoy yourself in payment for all you have done on my behalf." He clapped a palm on the docent's shoulder. "And when I return, safe after a month or two on Talagari, we can compare our separate experiences. You on amusement park rides, and me at the Suspenser Opera." The old teacher nodded thoughtfully. "I look forward to that, my friend." The lone traveler in the desert is a dead man. "Only the worm lives alone out there," Fremen saying. Given enough training, any Mentat could become a capable killer, an efficient and imaginative assassin. Peter de Vries, though, suspected that his own dangerous nature had to do with the original twisting
that enhanced his powers and made him what he was. His proclivity for cruelty, his sadistic enjoyment of the suffering of others, had been designed into his genetic blueprint by the Tlelaxu. Thus, House Harkonnen was the perfect home for him. Inside a high room of the Harkonnen residency at Carthag, DeVries stood before a mirror framed with lacy swirls of oil-black titanium. Using a cloth dipped in fragrant soap, he scrubbed around his mouth, then leaned close to examine the permanent Sappho stains. He powdered his pointed chin with makeup, but left the lips bright red. His ink-blue eyes and frizzy hair gave him the wild appearance of unpredictability. "I am too valuable to be used as a mere clerk." But the Baron didn't always see it that way. The fat fool often misused De Vries's talents, wasting his valuable time and energy. "I am not an accountant." He slithered into his personal study, filled with antique furnishings, racks of shigawire spools and film books. Film ledgers were scattered across his desk, covering the varnished blood grain. Any Mantat was overqualified to perform mere bookkeeping chores. De Vries had worked on ledgers before, but never enjoyed it. The tasks were too rudimentary, insultingly simple. But secrets must be kept, and the Baron trusted few people. Infuriated by the Fremen raid on the Hadith Melange Horde and several other hidden stockpiles, the Baron had instructed De Vries to check all Harkonnen financial ledgers to make certain they were in order, that they contained no evidence of the illegal spice stockpiles. All evidence must be expunged to avoid the attentions of an inquisitive Choam auditor. If the stockpiles were discovered, House Harkonnen could well lose its valuable Arrakis fief, and more, especially with the Emperor's newly announced hardline stance against spice hoarding. What is Shaddam thinking? De Vries sighed and resigned himself to the task. To make matters worse, the Baron's thick-skulled nephew, Glossu Rabban, had already gone through the records, without permission, and removed evidence with all the finesse of a dull gravedigger's shovel. The beast's baby brother, Fade Rautha, could have done a better job. Now the books were badly out of balance, leaving De Vries with more work than before. Far into the evening, he hunched over his desk. He drowned his subconscious in the numbers, absorbing data. With a magnetic scriber, he made changes, altering the first level of discrepancies, smoothing over the two obvious mistakes. But a tugging, peripheral thought kept pulling him out of his near trance. A drug-induced vision he had experienced 9 years ago, when he'd seen strange, unspecified trouble on the horizon for House Harkonnen. Inexplicable images of the Harkonnens abandoning Arrakis, the blue griffin banner taken down, to be replaced by the green and black of House Atreides. How could the Harkonnens possibly lose their spice monopoly? And what did the damnable Atreides have to do with it? De Vries needed more information. It was his sworn duty. More important than this miserable clerical work. He pushed the ledgers away, then went to his private pharmacopoeia. He let his fingers select bitter Sappho juice, Tikopia syrup, and 2 capsules of melange concentrate. He did not regulate the amounts he gulped. A pleasant, sweet, burning cinnamon essence exploded in his mouth. Hyperprescience, the verge of an overdose, a doorway opening. He saw more this time, information he needed. Baron Harkonnen, older and even heavier, being escorted by Sardaukar troops to a waiting shuttle. So the Baron himself would be forced to leave Arrakis, not some later generation of Harkonnens. The disaster would occur soon then. DeVries struggled to learn additional details, but swimming particles of light fuzzed his vision. He increased the dosage of drugs just enough to return the pleasurable sensation. But the visions did not come back, even as the chemicals rose up like a tidal wave. He awoke to find himself in the muscular arms of a pungent-smelling man with broad shoulders. His eyes came into focus a moment before his mind did. Rabban. The burly man hauled him along a rock-walled corridor, underground, beneath the Harkonnen residency.
"I'm doing you a favor," Rabban said, feeling the Mentat stir. "You were supposed to be working on the accounts. My uncle won't be pleased to learn what you've done to yourself. Again."
The Mentat could not think clearly, struggled to speak.
"I have learned something much more important."
In mid-sentence, DeVries was swung first to one side, then to the other. Then, with a splash, he landed in water. Water, of all things, here on Arrakis! Fighting the fog of drugs, he thrashed and dog-paddled to where Rabban knelt on a stone lip at the edge.
"Good thing you can swim. I hope you haven't soiled our cistern."
Furious, DeVries crawled out and lay gasping on the stone deck, dripping puddles that would have been worth a fortune to any Fremen servant. Rabban smirked. "The Baron could always replace you. The Tleilaxu would be only too happy to send us another Mentat grown from the same tank." Spluttering, DeVries tried to recover.
"I was working, you idiot, trying to enhance a vision that concerned the future of House Harkonnen."
Soaked, but trying to maintain his composure, the twisted Mentat pushed past the burly man and marched along the cool underground passages, then upstairs and ramps to the Baron's private suite. He pounded on the door, still dripping. Breathing hard, Rabban followed close behind. When the Baron came to the door, floating forward with hastily strapped-on suspensors, he looked irritated. His thick, reddish eyebrows knitted on his pasty face as he scowled. The Mentat's disheveled appearance did not seem to help.
"What's the meaning of coming to me at this time of night?" he sniffed. "You're wasting my water."
A mewling, bloody form lay broken on the far side of the Baron's reinforced bed. DeVries saw a pale hand twitching. Rabban pushed closer for a better view.
"Your Mentat has drugged himself again, Uncle."
A lizard tongue darted across DeVries's stained lips.
"Only in the line of duty, my Baron. And I have news, important, disturbing news."
Quickly he described the drug-induced vision he had experienced. The Baron puffed his fat cheeks.
"Damn all the trouble! My own stockpiles are under constant attack by those infernal Fremen, and now the Emperor is rattling his sword, threatening dire consequences for anyone who keeps a private cache. Now my own Mentat seeks out visions of my downfall. I grow weary of it."
"You don't believe his hallucinations, do you, Uncle?"
Rabban's gaze flicked uncertainly between the two men.
"Fine, then. We must prepare to suffer losses and replace what we have lost."
The Baron looked over his shoulder, anxious to get back to his playmate before the boy died on the floor.
"Rabban, I don't care what you have to do. Get me more spice."
Dressed in his stillsuit, Turok stood in the hot control room of a spice harvester. The huge machine groaned and creaked while it scooped material from a rich desert pit and deposited it into an onboard hopper. Screens, fans, and electrostatic fields separated melange from sand grains and purified the product. Exhaust dust belched out of the harvester's stacks and rear pipes as heavy treads hauled the mammoth machine across an exposed spice vein. Flakes of pure melange fell into armored containers. The detachable cargo hold was ready to be whisked away at the first sign of an approaching sandworm. Fremen, like Turok, occasionally volunteered to work on harvester crews, where they were valued for their desert skills. They were paid in cash, no questions asked. In doing so, Turok learned valuable information about city workers and spice crews. And information was power. So said Liet Kynes. Nearby, the harvester captain stood at a panel, studying screens projected by a dozen external cameras. A nervous man with a gritty beard, he worried that the spotter craft might not spot Wormsign in time to save the old machine.
"Use those strong Fremen eyes to keep us safe. That's what I pay you for."
Through the dusty window, Turok studied the hostile landscape, the undulating dunes. Despite the absence of movement, he knew the desert teemed with life, most of it hiding from the day's heat. He kept an eye out for deep tremors. Around the control room, three crewmen also peered through scratched and pitted windows, but they didn't have Fremen eyesight or training. Suddenly, Turok spotted a long, low mound on the distant sand, forming, growing.
"Wormsign!"
Using the Osborne direction finder by the window, he determined the exact coordinates and called them out.
"The spotter craft should have signaled us 5 minutes ago."
"I knew it, I knew it," the captain moaned. "Damn them, they still haven't called it in."
He got on the comm system and demanded a carry-all, then broadcast to his men out on the sand. They scrambled into rover vehicles and rushed back to the uncertain refuge of the harvester. Turok watched the sand mound racing toward him. Shai-Hulud always came to spice operations. Always. He heard a throbbing in the sky overhead, saw dust swirling around the harvester as a carry-all descended. The harvester shook while the crew scrambled to make connections, locking down cables and linkage hooks. Out on the sand, the worm raced closer, hissing through the dunes. The harvester shuddered again, and the captain cursed over the comm system.
"This is taking too long. Get us out of here, damn you!"
"Problem with the link-up, sir," a calm voice said over the speaker. "We are disconnecting you from the hopper and taking it by cargo sling. You're on your own." The captain screamed at the betrayal. Through the window, Turok saw the worm's head emerge from the sand, an ancient creature with sparkling crystal teeth and simmering flames in its gullet. The head quested one way and another as it picked up speed. A torpedo launched toward a target. While the rest of the crew scurried about, dependent on non-functional rescue equipment, Turok dived into a ragged escape chute that emptied him onto the sand away from the worm. The sharp odor of freshly exposed melange burned his nostrils. He saw that his stillsuit had torn. Struggling to his feet, Turok ran across the powdery slopes and watched the carry-all lift off with the spice hopper in a sling. None of the workers had been rescued, only the spice. Pumping his strong legs and keeping his balance on loose sand, Turok ran for his life. The other water-fat workers would never make it. He climbed a high dune, trying to gain distance, then stumbled along the rill. The vibrations of the monstrous harvester would mask his rhythmic footsteps for a time. He tumbled and rolled down a slip face, into the valley between dunes, then scrambled to escape the slow maelstrom as the worm circled and rose to devour its prey. Turok heard the roar behind him, felt the crumbly ground slip. Still he struggled in the loose sand and ran. He did not look back as the helpless spice harvester and crew fell into the cavernous gullet of Shai-Hulud. He heard the screams of men, the crunch of metal. 100 meters away, he saw a rock formation. If he could only reach it. Baron Harkonnen lay supine on a massage bed, his flabby skin hanging over the sides. Water misters sprayed his back and legs, making him sparkle like a perspiring Sumyun wrestler. Two pretty young men, dry-skinned and rangy, but the best he could find in Karthag,
kneaded ointments into his shoulders. An aide rushed in. "I'm sorry to interrupt, my Lord Baron, but we lost an entire harvester crew today. A carry-all arrived in time to offload the cargo, a full hopper, but could not rescue the men." The Baron half sat up, feigning disappointment. "No survivors?" With a casual wave of his hand, he dismissed the aide. "Speak to no one about this." He would order De Vries to record the loss of the machine and personnel, along with all of the spice. Naturally, the carry-all crew would need to be eliminated as witnesses, and the aide who had brought him the message. Perhaps these two young men also knew too much, but they would never survive the private exercises he planned for them anyway. He smiled to himself. People could be replaced so easily. Peace does not equate with stability. Stability is non-dynamic and never more than a hair's breadth from chaos. Fakan Butler, Findings of the Post-Jihad Council. "You will not be pleased to learn of this, my Emperor." Chamberlain Redondo bowed stiffly while Shaddam stepped down from the dais in the small state audience chamber. "Does no one ever bring me good news?" He fumed, thinking of all the annoying distractions that kept him from experiencing even a moment of peace. The thin chamberlain moved aside to let the Emperor pass, then hurried to catch up with him on the strip of red carpet. "There has been an incident on Baikal, sire." Though it was only early afternoon, Shaddam had terminated the rest of the day's appointments and informed the gathered lords and ambassadors that they would need to reschedule. Chamberlain Redondo would be left with the unenviable task of rearranging the meetings of everyone involved. "Baikal, what do I care about that place?" Scurrying to keep up with Shaddam's long strides, the man wiped perspiration from his high forehead. "The Atreides are involved. Duke Leto has taken us by surprise." Elegantly attired men and women stood around the audience chamber, engaged in whispered conversation. The exotic parquet floor of facet wood and inlaid kabuzu shells gave the chamber a rich glow in the golden light of balut crystal glow globes. Depending on his mood, the Emperor sometimes preferred the coziness and comparative informality of this small receiving room to the imperial audience chamber. Shaddam had wrapped himself in a long scarlet and gold cloak studded with emeralds, sou stones, and black sapphires. Beneath the lush robe he wore a bathing suit in anticipation of the warm canals and pools beneath the palace.